Before proceeding to reveal what is intended, I must make one last digression to explain how the Labour Party leader is elected, and thus could be toppled under the new rules recently introduced. From the inception of the Electoral College in 1980 until last year, the position was that, following an election, nominations for the post of party leader closed 30 days after the MP's oath-taking. There would then ensue 3 months, during which the rival candidates could press their claims before the Electoral College met. In the event of a Labour victory, it would be impossible for this procedure to work in favour of any candidate seeking to topple the newly elected and triumphant leader. But in 1968, a tiny reform was proposed and passed by a whisker. Under these new rules, the newly triumphant Labour Prime Minister is supposed to be confirmed in leadership quickly and efficiently by these means. Whenever in the year an election is held, and in the event of a Labour victory, any nominations for the party leadership would have to be in within 3 days of the national election result being declared. Then an extraordinary meeting of the Electoral College would take place within 7 days of the declaration of the election result. After the Electoral College meeting and the choice of the Labour Party leader, no further contest would be permitted for 2 years, the intervening year being waived. To those who had wavered in supporting the reform, it was pointed out that the procedure was simply a formality. The triumphant party leader, awaiting his call to Buckingham Palace to be charged by the Queen with forming a new government, would simply be massively endorsed by an unopposed re-election. It was out of the question, waverers were assured, for anyone to be so rash as to stand against such a winner. In fact, the reverse is intended. In the immediate wake of a Labour victory at the polls, before the triumphant leader had been called to the palace, an alternative candidate would be nominated to the extraordinary meeting of the Electoral College. He would be the pre-selected hard-left nominee to become Britain's first devout Marxist-Leninist premier. The outrage would be party-wide and country-wide, but only one side would be fully prepared to cope. The triumphant party leader would have to contest the election with the centrist and moderate elements in stunned disarray. The hard left would pull out every stop to secure the new candidate's election to the post, and they would win. First, the unions. Some unions, before casting their vote in the Electoral College, are obliged to consult their rank-and-file members by postal ballot, others through branch meetings, others through a national delegate conference. But inside 4 days, this would be impossible. The National Executive Committee would have to cast the vote on behalf of all their members unconsulted, and, as pointed out before, the executives are predominantly hard left. Second, the constituencies. Here it is calculated that half would vote for the new candidate. This campaign of the grassroots would be assisted by the release of a forged letter, apparently from the party leader to the national agent, indicating the leader's wish soon to revert to the old method, whereby the party leader was elected solely by the parliamentary party, thus disenfranchising the constituencies and the choice. Finally, the parliamentary party. With a fresh intake of new MPs, many already of the hard left, all aware they held their jobs in the gift of their constituency management committees, it is calculated half would vote for the new leader, having no allegiance to the old. But the preponderance in the unions would swing it for the new leader. Until recently, there was one major doubt in the plan. What would be the reaction of the throne? After profound consideration, the answer, with which I concur, would be none. For 2 reasons. 1. Precedent. When, in April 1976, Harold Wilson resigned the premiership, the Queen had to wait 2 weeks until she learned the identity of her own new Prime Minister and could invite him to Buckingham Palace for the ritual kissing of hands ceremony. In this instance, the wait would be 10 days. 2. Constitution. Since the throne had raised, as guardian of the unwritten British constitution, no objections to the several reforms of the Labour Party constitution at the times they took place, her advisers would have to point out that to object now that the Labour Party constitution was being required to operate would appear as an example of massive bias, so much so that it could provoke a constitutional crisis within the realm. Thus, the new party leader and prime minister would then have carte blanche, backed by a cabinet wholly in his own image, and begin upon the intended legislative programme forthwith. In short, the populace would have voted for an apparently soft-left traditionalist, or at least reformist, government, but a full hard-left regime would have taken office, without the irksome necessity of an intervening election. As for the legislative programme to which I have referred, this constitutes at this stage a plan of 20 desired measures, which have not yet, for obvious reasons, been put to paper. Some of the measures are already fully part of the Labour Party manifesto as they stand. Others are in the manifesto, but in watered-down form. Others have been seriously proposed at past Labour Party conferences, but not adopted, though in each case the votes have moved nearer for formal adoption each time the measure has been proposed over the past 10 years. All the other measures have been proposed at various times over the past 20 years within the hard left wing of the Labour Party. The 20-point plan is known as the Manifesto for the British Revolution, or MBR for short. I list below all 20 proposals, with added explanatory notes where necessary to explain what is intended. You'll observe that the first 15 refer to internal British matters and are of little direct applicability to Soviet policy, save in so much as they would reduce Britain to economic extinction and social chaos. But the last 5 points very much affect the Soviet Union and must constitute quite immeasurable benefits for her. Here, then, is the intended MBR. 1. The abolition of the entire private sector in medicine. All private clinics and hospitals, with their facilities, equipment and staff, to be taken over by the state, with compensation as and when deemed appropriate. 2. The abolition of the entire private sector in education. All schools and colleges, with their buildings, grounds, equipment and facilities, to be absorbed into the state sector, again with compensation as and when deemed appropriate. 3. The nationalisation of the 4 major issuing banks and the 20 top merchant banks, with enabling legislation to permit an extension of nationalisation to other banks in the event that they should grow in size. A ban on transfers of funds and deposits from the public to the private sector in banking. 4. The nationalisation of the top 500 corporations, industrial and commercial, within the present private sector. Compensation to be based on stock value 3 months after nationalisation and payable in treasury bonds maturing 10 years later. 5. The immediate abolition of the House of Lords and its power of legislative veto. This has already been part of the Labour Party manifesto for some years, including the phrase, and its power of legislative veto. Happily, the British people at large have failed to spot the slip in the use of this phrase. In fact, the House of Lords only has the power to delay legislation by asking the House of Commons to amend or reconsider. It retains a power of actual veto in only one case. Under Section 2 of the Parliament Act of 1911, the Lords lost its power of veto, save only in the case of a Commons extending its life by an act of self-perpetuation. Thus, the abolition of this power is vital to our friends in Britain. Evidently, the British Revolution cannot be stopped or put into reverse at the whim of the electorate. Thus, there could be no further general elections, a situation that could easily be guaranteed by the passage of an Emergency Powers Act of self-perpetuation. 6. The institution of a National Committee for Editorial Guidance. The committee would have its headquarters in the national capital, but a representation in every editorial office of newspapers, magazines, etc., and the land. The Editorial Guidance Committee would comprise one member of the editorial staff, one delegate of the print union, and one local appointee nominated by central office. Decisions as to what should be printed would depend on a simple majority among the three. The editor would sit in as an observer. 7. The institution of a new National Broadcasting Council to replace the BBC Board of Governors, the BBC Charter, and the Independent Broadcasting Authority. It would have powers of guidance over all programme content and all staff appointments within all the audio and visual media. 8. The institution of a National Council for the Reform of the Courts and Judiciary, apparently to ameliorate the tiresome delays in court procedure, in reality to remove unsound judges, appoint replacements, vet and approve all public appointments within the judiciary, to shorten or abolish much of the appeal procedure, and to extend the provision of in-camera hearings for offences against public order or for antisocial behaviour. 9. The institution of a Council for National Guidance in Education, with powers to approve or veto all appointments of lecturers, headmasters, and assistant teachers, and to revise the nation's educational programme so as to ensure the adoption of more socially aware curricula in schools and colleges. 10. The passage of the Trade Union, Extension to Armed Forces and Police, Bill, requiring the mandatory membership of the appropriate trade union of all members of the armed forces and the police, and the introduction into the forces and police of civilian union organisers and educators. Clearly, in a closed-shop situation, expulsion from the union would then require resignation from the force. 11. The passage of the Police Authorities Bill. This would subject all police forces to the local police authority, which would be drawn from progressive elements in local government and the trade union movement, who would have power of appointment of all ranks from chief constable down to sergeant, and the predominant voice in the delineation of strategy and tactics in local community policing. 12. The passage of the Public Order Community Safeguard Act, whose main provision would be to bring into being the workers' militia to replace the special constabulary. The militia would support the local police in the maintenance of public order, principally in the ensuring of safe and orderly pro-government demonstrations and the disruption of any anti-social elements who might wish to dissent. 13. The Currency Exchange Control Restoration Bill. This speaks for itself. It would inevitably be necessary to prohibit all outflight of funds and assets from the country. 14. The passage of the Private Wealth Accountability Act, requiring the registration of all land, pictures, jewellery, artefacts, stocks, shares, deposits, vehicles, pension funds, houses, etc., prior to their taxation or nationalisation in lieu. 15. The passage of the Direction of Investment Enabling Act, requiring the registration of all corporate funds, such as those held by life offices, insurance corporations, etc., to enable the direction of future investment into state-favoured projects on the advice, mandatory, of government-appointed experts. 16. The immediate withdrawal, regardless of any treaty obligations, from the European Economic Community. 17. The downscaling, without delay, of all Britain's conventional armed forces to one-fifth of their present size. 18. The immediate abolition and destruction of all Britain's nuclear weapons and the dismantling of the two advanced weapons research establishments at Harwell and Aldermaston. 19. The expulsion from Britain, without delay, of all United States forces, nuclear and conventional, along with all their personnel and material. 20. The immediate withdrawal from and repudiation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I need hardly underline, Comrade General Secretary, that these last five proposals would wreck the defences of the Western Alliance beyond any possible hope of repair in our lifetime, if indeed ever. Obviously, everything I have outlined and described within the two memoranda depend for their full implementation upon a Labour Party victory. And for this, the next election, expected in the spring of 1988, may well be the last opportunity. All the above was, in fact, what I meant by my remark at General Kryuchkov's dinner, that the political stability of Britain is constantly overestimated in Moscow, and never more so than at the present time. Yours sincerely, Harold Adrian Russell Philby. The General Secretary's response to the second and final memorandum was surprisingly and gratifyingly prompt. Barely more than a day after Philby had consigned the memorandum into the hands of Major Pavlov, the inscrutable and cold-eyed young officer from the Ninth Directorate was back. He bore in his hand a single manila envelope, which he handed to Philby without a word before turning away. It was another handwritten letter from the General Secretary, personally, brief and to the point, as usual. In it, the Soviet leader thanked his friend Philby for his efforts. He himself had been able to confirm the bulk of the two memoranda as perfectly accurate. In consequence, he estimated the victory of the British Labour Party at the next general election in that country to have become a matter of top priority for the USSR. He was calling into being a small, restricted advisory committee, responsible and answerable only to himself, to counsel him upon possible future courses. He required and requested Harold Philby to act as advisor to that committee. Chapter 6. Preston sat down in the office of a very worried Bertie Capstick and examined the 10 photocopied sheets spread out on the desk, reading each carefully. "How many people have handled the envelope?" he inquired.
"The postman, obviously. God knows how many people in the sorting office. Inside the building, the front office people, the messenger who brings the morning mail up to the offices, and myself. I can't see you'll get much joy out of the envelope."
"And the papers inside?"
"Just myself, Johnny. Of course, I didn't know what they were until I pulled them out."
Preston thought for a while. "Apart from the person who mailed them, they might, I suppose, contain the prints of the person who removed them. I'll have to ask Scotland Yard to check them out for prints. Don't have much hope, personally. Now for the contents. It looks like very high-level stuff."
"The tops," said Capstick gloomily. "Nothing short of top secret, the lot. Some of it very sensitive, concerning our NATO allies. Contingency plans for NATO to counter a variety of Soviet threats, that sort of stuff."
"All right," said Preston. "Let's just run through the possibilities. Bear with me. Supposing this was sent back by a public-spirited citizen who, for one reason or another, did not want to be identified. It happens. People don't want to get involved. Where could such a person have got them? A briefcase left in a cloakroom, a taxi, or a club?"
Capstick shook his head. "Not legally, Johnny. This stuff should never, under any circumstances, have left the building, except possibly in the sealed bag to go across for the Foreign Office and Cabinet Office. And there have been no reports of a registry bag being tampered with. Besides, they're not marked for a destination outside this building as they would be if they had left legitimately. And the people who would even begin to have access to this sort of stuff know the rules. No one, but no one, may take this sort of stuff home to study. Answer your question?"
"More than somewhat," said Preston. "It came back from outside the Ministry, so it had to be taken outside illegally. Gross negligence, or a deliberate attempt to leak?"
"Look at the dates of origin," said Capstick. "These 10 sheets cover a full month. There's no chance they all arrived on a single desk in a single day. They had to be collected over a period."
Preston, using his handkerchief, eased the 10 documents back into their envelope of arrival. "I'll have to take them to Charles Street, Bertie. May I use your phone?" He called Charles Street and asked to be put straight through to the office of Sir Bernard Hemmings. The Director-General was in, and after a delay and some insistence from Preston, took the call personally. Preston simply asked for a personal appointment within minutes, and got it. He put down the phone and turned to Brigadier Capstick. "Bertie, for the moment, don't do anything or say anything to anyone. Just play out the day as if it was another routine day," said Preston. "I'll be in touch." It was out of the question to leave the Ministry with these documents, but without an escort. Brigadier Capstick loaned him one of the front hall commissionaires, a burly former guardsman. Preston left the Ministry with the documents in his own briefcase and took a taxi to Clarges' apartments, watching the vehicle disappear down the street before walking the last 200 yards down Clarges Street to Charles Street at his head office, where he could dismiss his escort. Sir Bernard saw him 10 minutes later. The old spycatcher looked grey, as if he was in pain, which he frequently was. The disease that was growing deep inside him showed nothing to the observer, but the medical tests left no doubt. 1 year, they had said, and not operable. He was due to retire on the 1st of September, which with terminal leave meant he could depart in mid-July, 6 weeks before his 60th birthday. He would probably have gone already, but for the personal responsibilities that bore upon him. He had a second wife who had brought to the marriage a stepdaughter on whom the childless man doted. The girl was still at school. Early retirement would severely curtail his pension, leaving his widow and the girl in straitened circumstances. Wisely or not, he sought to carry on until the statutory retirement date and be able to leave behind his full pension. After a lifetime in the job, he had virtually no other asset to leave them. Preston explained briefly and concisely what had happened at the Ministry of Defence that morning, and the view of Capstick regarding the feasibility of the document's departure from the Ministry being anything other than a deliberate act.
"Oh, my God, not another," murmured Sir Bernard.
Years later, the memory of Vassal and Prime still rankled, as did the acid reaction of the Americans when they had been apprised.
"Well, John, where do you want to start?"
"I've told Bertie Capstick to stay silent for the moment," said Preston. "If we have a genuine traitor inside the Ministry, there's a second mystery. Who sent the stuff back to us?"
passerby, sneak thief, wife with remorse feelings, we don't know. But if we could find that person, we might find where they got the stuff. That would short-circuit a lot of inquiry. I don't hold out much hope for the envelope. Standard brown paper, sold in thousands of outlets. Normal stamps, address in block capitals, felt-tip pen, and already handled by a score of anonymous people. But the papers inside might have retained prints. I'd like Scotland Yard to test them all, under supervision, of course. After that, we may know where we go next. Good thinking. You handle that side of it, said Sir Bernard. I'll have to tell Tony Plum and probably Perry Jones. I'll try and set up a meeting over lunch with them both. It depends on what Perry Jones thinks, of course, but we have to set up the GIC on this one. You get on with your side, John, and stay in touch with me. If the Yard comes up with anything, I shall want to know. Down at Scotland Yard, they were very helpful, putting one of their best lab men at Preston's disposal. Preston stood by the civilian technician as he carefully dusted every sheet. The man could not help reading the top secret heading on each sheet. "Someone been naughty down in Whitehall?" the technician asked archly. Preston shook his head. "Stupid and lazy," he lied. "That stuff should have been in the shredder, not a waste paper basket. It'll be a hell of a rap in the knuckles for the clerk responsible, if we can identify the knuckles." The technician lost interest. When he had finished, he shook his head. "Nothing," he said. "Clean as a whistle. But I'll tell you one thing. They've been wiped. There's one clear set of prints, of course. Probably your own." Preston nodded. There was no need to reveal that the single set of prints belonged to Brigadier Capstick. "That's the point," said the technician. "This paper will take prints beautifully and keep them for weeks, maybe months. There ought to be at least one other set, probably more. The clerk who touched them before you, for example. But nothing. Before they went in the waste paper basket, they were wiped with a cloth. I can see the fibres, but no prints. Sorry." Preston had not even offered him the envelope. Whoever had wiped them was not going to leave his own prints on the envelope. Moreover, the envelope would give the lie to his cover story about the negligent clerk. He took the 10 secret documents and left. Capstick was right, he thought. It's a leak, and a bad one. It was 3 in the afternoon. He went back to Charles Street and waited for Sir Bernard. Sir Bernard, with some urging, got his lunch with Sir Anthony Plum, chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, the JIC, and Sir Peregrine Jones, permanent undersecretary at the Defence Ministry. They met in a private room in a St. James Club. Both the other senior civil servants were perturbed by the urgency of the request from the DG of 5, and ordered their lunch rather pensively. When the waiter had left, Sir Bernard told them what had happened. It ruined both men's appetites.
"I wish Capstick had spoken to me," said Sir Perry Jones with some annoyance. "Damned unsettling to be told like this."
"I think," said Sir Bernard, "my man Preston asked him to stay silent a while longer, because if we have a leak high in the ministry, he mustn't be tipped off we got the documents back." Sir Peregrine grunted, slightly mollified.
"What do you think, Perry?" asked Sir Anthony Plum. "Any innocent or simply negligent way that stuff could have left the ministry in photocopy form?"
The top civil servant in defence shook his head.
"The leak needn't be all that high," he said. "All the top men have personal staffs. Copies have to be made. Sometimes 3 or 4 men have to see an original document. But copies are listed as they are made and later shredded. 3 copies taken, 3 copies shredded after use. The trouble is, a senior man can't shred all his own stuff. He'll give it to one of his staff for shredding. They're vetted, of course, but no system is completely perfect. The thing is, those copies, spanning a whole month between them, being taken outside the ministry, that can't be accidental or even negligent. That has to be deliberate, damn it." He put down his knife and fork on an almost untouched meal.
"I'm sorry, Tony. I think we've got a bad one." Sir Tony Plum looked grave.
"I think I'm going to have to call into being a restricted subcommittee of the JIC," he said. "At this stage, very restricted. Just Home Office, Foreign Office, Defence, the Cabinet Secretary, heads of 5 and 6, and someone from GCHQ. I can't get it smaller."
It was agreed he would set up the subcommittee for a meeting the next morning, and Hemmings would inform them of any luck by Preston at Scotland Yard. On that note,
they parted. The full JIC is a rather large committee. Apart from half a dozen ministries and several agencies, the three armed forces and the two intelligence services, it would also include the London-based representatives of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and, of course, America's CIA. Plenary meetings tend to be rare and rather formal. Restricted subcommittees are more the rule, because those present, concerned with a specific issue, tend to know each other personally and can get through more work in less time. The subcommittee, Sir Anthony Plum, had, as chairman of the JIC and the Prime Minister's personal coordinator of intelligence, convened on the morning of 21st January, was codenamed Paragon. It met at 10 a.m. in the Cabinet Office briefing room, known as Cobra, two floors below ground level in the Cabinet Office on Whitehall, a conference room that is air-conditioned, soundproof, and swept daily for listening devices. Technically, their host was the Cabinet Secretary, Sir Martin Flannery, but he deferred to Sir Anthony, who took the chair. Sir Perry Jones was there from Defence, Sir Patrick Paddy Strickland from the Foreign Office, and Sir Hubert Villiers from the Home Office, which politically commands MI5. GCHQ, the Government Communications Headquarters, the country's listening service down in Gloucestershire, so important in a highly technical age that it is almost an intelligence service in its own right, had sent its Deputy Director-General, the DG being away on vacation. Sir Bernard Hemmings came from Charles Street, bringing with him Brian Harcourt-Smith. "I thought it would be better if Brian were fully in the picture," Hemmings had explained to Sir Anthony. Everyone understood, he meant, in case I cannot attend on a future occasion. The last man present, sitting impassively at the end of the long table opposite Sir Anthony Plum, was Sir Nigel Irvin, the chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6. Oddly, although MI5 has a director-general, MI6 does not. It has a chief, known throughout the intelligence world and Whitehall simply as C, whatever his name may be. Nor, even more oddly, does C stand for chief. The first head of MI6 was called Mansfield Cumming, and the C is the initial of the second half of that name. Ian Fleming, ever tongue-in-cheek, took the other initial, M, for the chief in his James Bond novels. All in all, there were 9 men round the table, 7 of them knights of the realm, who between them represented more power and influence than any other 7 men in the kingdom. They all knew each other well and were on first-name terms. Each could call the two deputy directors-general by the first name, but the DDGs would refer to the senior men as Sir, it was understood. Sir Anthony Plum opened the meeting with a brief description of the previous day's discovery, which evoked mutters of consternation, and passed the narrative to Sir Bernard Hemmings. The head of 5 filled in more details, including the dead end from Scotland Yard. Sir Perry Jones concluded with his insistence that there could have been no accidental or merely negligent departure of those photocopies from inside the ministry. It would have to be deliberate and clandestine. When he had finished, there was silence round the table. 2 single words hung like a spectre above them all. Damage assessment. How long had it been going on? How many documents had gone missing? To what destination? That seemed fairly obvious. What kinds of documents had gone, how much damage had been done to Britain and the NATO alliance, and how the devil do we tell our allies? "Who have you got handling it?" asked Sir Martin Flannery of Hemmings. "His name's John Preston," said Hemmings. "He's C1A. The ministry's man, Brigadier Capstick, called him when the package arrived in the mail. Could we allocate someone more experienced?" suggested Brian Harcourt-Smith. Sir Bernard Hemmings frowned. "John Preston is a late entrant," he explained. "Been with us 6 years. I've every confidence in him. There is another reason. We have to assume there is a deliberate leak." Sir Perry Jones nodded glumly. "We can also assume," continued Hemmings, "that the person responsible, I'll call him or her Chummy, is aware of the loss of those documents from their possession. We can hope Chummy does not know they have been anonymously returned to the ministry. Still, Chummy is likely to be worried and lying low. If I put in a whole team of ferrets, Chummy will know it's over. The last thing we need is a moonlight flit and a starring role at an international press conference in Moscow. I suggest for the moment we try to keep it low profile and see if we can get an early lead.
As a newly appointed C1A, Preston can reasonably make a tour of the ministries and check, in an apparently routine fashion, on procedures. It's as good a cover as we'll get. With a bit of luck, Chummy will think nothing of it. From his end of the table, Sir Nigel Irvin nodded. Makes sense, he said.
Any chance of a lead through one of your sources, Nigel?
Asked Anthony Plum.
I'll put out some feelers, he said noncommittally.
Andreev, he was thinking. He would have to set up a meet with Andreev.
What about our gallant allies?
Informing them, or some of them, will probably come to you, Plum reminded Irvin. So what do you think?
Sir Nigel had been in his office for 7 years and was in his last year. Subtle, experienced, and impassive, he was held in high regard by the Allied Intelligence Services of Europe and North America. Still, being the bearer of these tidings was going to be no joke. Not a good note on which to leave the game. He was thinking of Alan Fox, the CIA's acerbic and occasionally sarcastic senior liaison man in London. Alan was going to make a 5-course dinner out of this. He shrugged and smiled.
I agree with Bernard. Chummy must be a worried man. I think we can assume he will not rush to purloin another bunch of top-secret material in the next few days. It would be nice to be able to go to our allies as some sort of progress, some kind of damage assessment. Now, I'd like to wait and see what this man Preston can do, at least for a few days.
Damage assessment is of the essence, nodded Sir Anthony. And that seems almost impossible until we can find Chummy and persuade him to answer a few questions. So, for the moment, we seem to depend on Preston's progress.
Sounds like the title of a book, muttered one of the group as they broke up. The permanent undersecretaries heading to brief their ministers in closest confidence, and Sir Martin Flannery, knowing he was going to have an uncomfortable few moments with the redoubtable Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. The following day, in Moscow, another committee had its inaugural meeting. Major Pavlov had called him just after lunch to say that he would collect the Comrade Colonel at 6. The Comrade General Secretary of the CPSU wished to see him. Philby supposed, rightly, that the 5-hour warning was so that he could be sober and properly dressed. The roads at that hour, in driving snow, had been clogged with crawling traffic, but the Chaika, with the MOC number plates, had sped down the centre lane reserved for the Vlasti, the elite, the fat cats in what had become of Marx's dreamed-of classless society, a society rigidly structured, layered, and class-ridden as only a vast bureaucratic hierarchy can be. When they passed the Ukraina Hotel, Philby had thought they might be going all the way to the Dacha at Usova, but after half a mile they swung towards the barred entrance of the huge 80-story block at 26 Kutuzovsky Prospekt. Philby was amazed. To enter the private living quarters of the Politburo was a rare honour. There were plain-clothes 9th Directorate men up and down the pavement, but at the steel entrance gate they were in uniform, thick grey coats, fur shapkas with the ear flaps down, and the blue insignia of the Kremlin guards. Major Pavlov identified himself, and the steel gates swung open. The Chaika crept into the courtyard of the hollow square and parked. Without a word, the Major led him into the building, through 2 more identity checks, a hidden metal detector and X-ray scanner, and into the lift. At the 3rd floor they stepped out. This entire floor belonged to the General Secretary. Major Pavlov knocked on a door. It opened to reveal a major domo in white, who gestured Philby inside. The silent major stepped back, and the door closed behind Philby. Stewards took his coat and hat, and he was ushered into a large sitting room, very warm, since old men feel the cold, but surprisingly simply furnished. Unlike Leonid Brezhnev, who had loved the ornate, the rococo, and the luxurious, the General Secretary was known to be an ascetic man in his private tastes. The furniture was Swedish or Finnish whitewood, spare, clean-cut, and functional. Apart from 2, no doubt, priceless Bokhara rugs, there was nothing antique. There was a low coffee table and 4 chairs grouped around it, the group being open at one end to permit a 5th absent chair. Still standing, no one was about to sit without permission, were 3 men. Philby knew them all, and they nodded greetings. One was Professor Vladimir Ilyich Krylov. He was a professor of modern history lecturing at Moscow University. His real importance was as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of the socialist and communist parties of Western Europe, specializing in Britain. More importantly, he was a member of the Supreme Soviet, the USSR's rubber stamp, one-party parliament, a member of the Academy of Sciences, and a frequent consultant of the International Department of the Central Committee, of which the General Secretary had once been the head. The man in civilian clothes, but with a soldierly bearing, was General Pyotr Sergeyevich Marchenko, whom Philby knew only vaguely, but was aware to be a senior officer in the GRU, the Soviet Armed Forces' own military intelligence arm. Marchenko was an expert in the techniques of internal security and its counterpart, destabilization, and his particular study had always been the democracies of Western Europe, whose police and internal security forces he had studied half his life. The third was Dr. Yosef Viktorovich Rogov, also an academician, a physicist by discipline, but his fame lay in another title, chess grand master. He was known to be one of the General Secretary's few personal friends, a man on whom the Soviet leader had called several times in the past when he felt he needed to use that remarkable brain in the planning stages of certain operations. The four men had been there 2 minutes when the double doors at the end of the room opened, and the undisputed master of Soviet Russia, her dominions, satellites, and colonies, entered. He was in a wheelchair, pushed by a tall steward in a white jacket. The chair was propelled to the vacant space left for it. "Please be seated," said the General Secretary. Philby was surprised by the changes in the man. At 75, the face and the backs of the hands were blotched and mottled in the manner of very old men. The open-heart surgery of 1985 seemed to have worked, and the pacemaker appeared to be doing its job, and yet he looked frail. The white hair, thick and lustrous in the May Day portraits, making him look like every family's favourite doctor, had almost vanished. There were brown smudges round both eyes. A mile up the Kutuzovsky Prospect, near the old village of Kuntsevo, set in a huge territory inside a 2-metre timber palisade fence in the heart of a birch forest, stood the hyper-exclusive Central Committee Hospital. It was a modernization and extension of the old Kuntsevo clinic. In the grounds of the hospital stood Stalin's old dacha, the surprisingly modest bungalow where the tyrant had spent so much of his time and finally died. The whole of this dacha had been converted into the country's most modern intensive care medical unit for the benefit of one man, who now sat in his wheelchair, studying them one by one. 6 top specialists were on permanent call at the dacha at Kuntsevo, and to them each week went the General Secretary for treatment. It was evident they were keeping him alive, just. But the brain was still there, behind the chilly eyes that looked through the gold-rimmed glasses. He blinked rarely, and when he did, slowly, like a bird of prey. He wasted no time with preamble. Philby knew he never did. Nodding to the other three, he said, "You comrades have read the 2 memoranda of our friend, Comrade Colonel Philby." It was not a question, but the other three nodded their assent. "Then you will experience no surprise to learn that I regard the victory of Britain's Labour Party, and thence of the ultra-left wing of that party, as a priority of Soviet interest. I wish you four to form a very discreet committee to advise me on any method that might occur to you that would enable us to assist, completely covertly, of course, in that victory. You will discuss this with no one. Documents, if any, will be prepared personally. Notes will be burned. Meetings will be held in personal residences. You will not associate in public. You will consult no one else. And you will report to me personally by telephoning here and speaking to Major Pavlov. I will then arrange a meeting at which you can report your proposals." It was clear to Philby the Soviet leader was taking the confidentiality extremely seriously. He could have held this meeting at his suite of offices in the Central Committee building, the big grey block on Novaya Plushchit, where all Soviet leaders have worked since Stalin. But other Politburo members could have seen them arriving or leaving, or heard about it. The General Secretary was evidently establishing a committee that was so totally private to himself that no one was to be allowed to know of it. There was another odd thing. Apart from himself, and he was in retirement, There was no one from the KGB present. Yet the first chief directorate had massive files on Britain and experts to match. For reasons of his own, the wily leader had chosen to keep the matter outside the service of which he had once been chairman. Are there any points of query?
Philby raised a tentative hand. The General Secretary nodded.
Comrade General Secretary, I used to drive myself around in my own Volga. Since my stroke last year, the doctors have prohibited this. Now my wife drives me. But in this instance, for the sake of confidentiality, I will assign a KGB driver to you for the duration, said the General Secretary softly. They all knew the other three men already had drivers, as of right. There were no other points. At a nod, the steward propelled the wheelchair and its occupant back through the doors. The four advisers rose and prepared to leave. 2 days later, in the country dacha of one of the two academics, the Albion Committee went into intensive session.
Book title or not, Preston was making some progress. Even while the inaugural session of Paragon was going on, he was ensconced in the registry, deep under the Ministry of Defence.
Bertie, he had told Brigadier Capstick, so far as the staff here are concerned, I'm just a new broom making a bloody nuisance of himself. Put it about that I'm simply trying to make a mark with my own superiors. Routine checking of procedures, nothing to worry about, a pain in the arse. Capstick had done his bit, trumpeting that the new head of C1A was going through all the ministries, showing what an eager beaver he was. The registry clerks rolled their eyes to heaven and cooperated with thinly veiled exasperation. But it gave Preston access to the files, the withdrawals and the returns, to whom, and most importantly, over what dates. He had one early break. All the documents but one would have been available at the Foreign Office or the Cabinet Office, since they all touched upon Britain's NATO allies and the areas of joint NATO response to a variety of possible Soviet initiatives. But one document had not gone outside the ministry. The permanent Undersecretary, Sir Peregrine Jones, had recently returned from talks in Washington with the Pentagon. The subject had been joint patrolling by British and American nuclear submarines in the Mediterranean and in the Central and South Atlantic and Indian Oceans. He had prepared a draft paper on his talks and circulated it to a score of senior mandarins inside the ministry. The fact that it was among the stolen papers, in photocopy form, meant at least that the leak was inside the one ministry. Preston began an analysis of the distribution of top-secret documents, going back for months. It became clear the documents in the returned package covered a period, first and last, of 4 weeks. It was also plain that every mandarin who had had all those documents across his desk had also had more than these, so the thief was being selective. There were 24 men who could have had access to all the 10 documents, Preston established at the end of his second day. Then he began checking absences from office, trips abroad, incidences of flu, eliminating those who could not have had access within the period of theft. He was hampered by two things. He had to pretend to examine a host of other withdrawals in order not to draw attention to those particular 10 documents. Even registry clerks gossip, and the leak could have been a low-level staffer, a secretary or typist level, capable of exchanging coffee-break gossip with a clerk. Secondly, he could not penetrate to the floors above to check on the number of photocopies made of originals. He knew it was common for one man to have a top-secret document officially out to him by name, but for that man to wish to take the advice of a colleague, so a photocopy would be run off, numbered, and given to the colleague. On its return it would be shredded, or in this case, not. The master document would then go back to registry, but several pairs of eyes could have seen the photocopies. To solve the second problem, he returned to the ministry with Capstick after dark, and spent 2 nights in the upper floors, empty apart from the incurious cleaning ladies, checking the number of copies run off. More eliminations were made possible, where a document went to a senior civil servant who made no copies at all before returning it to registry. On the 27th of January, he reported back to Charles Street with an interim progress sheet. It was Brian Harcourt Smith who received him. Sir Bernard was away from the office again.
"Glad you got something for us, John," said Harcourt Smith. I've had 2 calls from Anthony Plum. It seems the Paragon people are pressing.
Shoot. First, said Preston, the documents. They were carefully selected, as if our thief was taking the sort of stuff he'd been asked for. That requires expertise. I think that counts out really low-level staffers. They would operate on the magpie syndrome, grabbing what came by. It's tentative, but it cuts down the numbers. I think it's somebody of experience, and with an awareness of content, which counts out clerks and messengers. In any case, the leak isn't in the registry. No broken bag seals, no illicit withdrawals or unauthorized copying. Harcourt Smith nodded. So you think it's upstairs?
Yes, Brian, I do.
Here's the second reason why. I spent 2 nights checking every single copy made. There are no discrepancies. So it leaves only one thing, the shredding of copies. Someone has had 3 copies to shred, and shredded only 2, smuggling the 3rd out of the building. Now to numbers of senior men who could have done that. There were 24 who could have had access to all 10 documents. I think I can count out 12, because they only got copies, 1 copy each, on a give-me-your-advice basis. The rules are quite clear. A man receiving a photocopy on that basis must return it to the man who sent it to him. To retain 1 would be irregular and arouse suspicion. To retain 10 would be unheard of. So, one comes to the 12 men who had the originals out from the registry. Of these, 3 were away for varying reasons on the days shown as the withdrawal dates on the photocopies returned by the anonymous sender. Those men made their withdrawals on other days and must be counted out. That leaves 9. Of those 9, 4 never had any copies made for advisory purposes at all, and of course unauthorized copying without logging is not possible.
And then there were 5, murmured Harcourt Smith.
Right. Now, it's only tentative, but it's the best I can do for the moment. 3 of those 5, during that period, had other documents on their desks that fall well within the type of the stolen papers, and which were much more interesting, but which were not stolen. By rights, they ought to have been stolen. So I come down to 2 men. Nothing certain, just prime suspects. He pushed 2 files across the desk to Harcourt Smith, who looked at them with curiosity. Sir Richard Peters and Mr. George Berenson, he read. The first being the Assistant Undersecretary responsible for international and industrial policy, and the second the Deputy Chief of Defence Procurement. Both men would have personal staffs, of course.
Yes.
But you are not listing them as suspects.
May I ask why?
They are suspects, said Preston. Those 2 men would probably rely on their staffs to make the copies and later shred them, but that widens the net to 12 people. If one could clear the 2 top men, trapping the underling with the department head's cooperation would be child's play. I'd like to start with the top 2.
What are you asking for? Said Harcourt Smith.
Total covert surveillance on both men for a limited period, with postal intercept and telephone tap, said Preston.
I'll ask the Paragon Committee, said Harcourt Smith, but these are senior men. You'd better be right.
The second meeting of Paragon took place in the Cobra that late afternoon. Harcourt Smith deputized for Sir Bernard Hemmings. He had a transcript of Preston's report for everyone present. The senior men read the report in silence. When all had finished, Sir Anthony Plum asked,
"Well?"
"Seems logical," said Sir Hubert Villiers.
"I think Mr. Preston has done well in the time," said Sir Nigel Irvine. Harcourt Smith smiled thinly.
"Of course, it could be neither of these 2 very senior men," he said.
"A girl clerk, given the copies to shred, could just have easily taken all 10 documents."
Brian Harcourt Smith was the product of a very minor private school and carried on his shoulder a sizable and quite unnecessary chip. Beneath his polished veneer, he had a considerable capacity for resentment. All his life he had resented the seemingly effortless ease which the men around him could bring to the business of life. He resented their endless and interwoven network of contacts and friendships, often forged long ago in schools, universities, or fighting regiments, on which they could draw when they wished. It was called the Old Boy Network, or the Magic Circle, and he resented, most of all, that he was not a member of it. One day, he had told himself many times, when he had the Director Generalship and his knighthood, he would sit among these men as equals,
and they would listen, really listen to him. Down the table, Sir Nigel Irvine, a receptive man, caught a look in Harcourt Smith's eyes and was troubled. There was a capacity for anger in that man, he mused. Irvine was a contemporary of Sir Bernard Hemming's, and they went back a long way. He wondered about the succession in the autumn. He wondered about the anger in Harcourt Smith, the hidden ambition, and where they might both lead, or perhaps already had.
"Oh, we've heard what Mr. Preston wants," said Sir Anthony Plum. "Total surveillance. Does he get it?"
The hands went up. Every Friday in MI5 is held what they call the bidding conference. The director of K is in the chair, head of the joint sections. At the bidding conference, the other directors put in their request for what they think they need. Finance, technical services, the surveillance of their pet suspects. The pressure is always on Director A, who controls the watchers. That week, the Friday conference was preempted as far as the watchers were concerned. Those attending on Friday the 30th of January found the cupboard was bare. 2 days earlier, Harcourt Smith, at the requirement of Paragon, had allocated Preston the watchers he wanted. At 6 watchers to a team, 4 forming the box and 2 in parked cars, and 4 teams in every 24 hours, and with 2 men to survey, he had taken 48 watchers off other duties. There was some outrage, but nobody could do anything about it.
"There are 2 targets," the briefing officers in Cork told the teams. "This one and this one. One is married, but his wife is away in the country. They live in a West End apartment, and he usually walks to the minister every morning, about a mile and a half. The other is a bachelor, and lives outside Edenbridge in Kent. He commutes by train every day. We start tomorrow."
Technical support took care of the telephone tap and the mail intercept, and both Sir Richard Peters and Mr. George Berenson went under the microscope. They were just too late to observe the delivery by hand of a package at Fontenoy House. It was collected from the hall porter by the addressee on his return from work. It contained a replica, using zirconium stones, of the Glen Suite, and was deposited with Coutts Bank the following day.
Chapter 7. Friday the 13th is supposed to be an unlucky day, but for John Preston it was the opposite. It brought him his first break in the wearisome tailing of the 2 senior civil servants. The surveillance had gone on for 16 days without results. Both men were creatures of habit, and neither was surveillance conscious. That is, they did not look for a tail, and therefore made the watcher's task easy, but boring. The Londoner left his Belgravia apartment every day at the same hour, walked to Hyde Park Corner, turned down Constitution Hill and across St. James's Park. That brought him to Horse Guards Parade. He went across this, traversed Whitehall, and straight into the Ministry. He sometimes lunched out, sometimes inside. He spent most evenings at home or in his club. The commuter, who lived alone in a picturesque cottage outside Edenbridge, caught the same train to London each day, strolled from Charing Cross Station to the Ministry, and disappeared inside. The watchers housed him each night and kept chilly vigil until relieved at dawn by the first day team. Neither man did anything suspicious. Mail intercept and phone taps on both men showed up only the usual bills, personal mail, banal phone calls, and a modest and respectable social life. Until the 13th of February. Preston, as operations controller, was in the radio link room in the basement at Cork Street when a call came through from the B team following Sir Richard Peters. Joe was hailing a cab. We're behind him in the cars. In watcher parlance, the target is always Joe, Chummy, or our friend. When the B team came off shift, Preston had a session with its leader, Harry Birkinshaw. He was a small, rotund man, middle-aged, a veteran of his job-for-life profession, who could spend hours blended into the background of a London street, and then move with remarkable speed if the target tried to slip him. He was wearing a plaid jacket, pork-pie hat, carried a raincoat, and wore a camera around his neck, like an ordinary American tourist. As with all watchers, the hat, jacket, and raincoat were soft and reversible, providing 6 combinations. Watchers treasure their props.
and the various roles into which they can slip in a matter of seconds. "So what happened, Harry?" Preston asked.
"He came out of the ministry at the usual time. We picked him up, got him in the middle of the box, but instead of walking in the usual direction, he went as far as Trafalgar Square and hailed a cab. We were at the end of the shift. We alerted our mates on the swing shift to hold station and set off after the cab. He dismissed it by Panzer's Delicatessen on Bayswater Road and ducked down Clanricarde Gardens. Halfway down, he shot into a front forecourt and went down the steps to the basement. One of my lads got close enough to see there was nothing down the steps but the door of the basement flat. He'd shot in there. Then my boy had to move on. Joe was coming back out again and up the steps. He went back to Bayswater Road, took another cab, and headed for the West End again. After that, he resumed his normal routine. We passed him to the swing shift at the bottom of Park Lane.
How long was he down the basement steps?
30-40 seconds, said Birkinshaw. Either he was let in damn fast or he had his own key. No light showing inside. Looked like he'd stopped by to pick up mail or check for any.
What kind of house?
Dirty-looking house. Dirty-looking basement. It'll all be in the log in the morning. Mind if I go now? My feet are killing me.
Preston spent the evening wondering about the incident. Why on earth would Sir Richard Peters want to visit a seedy flat in Bayswater for 40 seconds? He couldn't see someone inside, not enough time. Pick up mail, or leave a message. He arranged for the house to be put under surveillance as well, and a car with a man and a camera in it was there within an hour. Weekends are weekends. Preston could have roused the civilian authorities to start investigating the apartment through Saturday and Sunday, but that would have caused waves. This was an ultra-covert surveillance. He decided to wait until Monday. The Albion Committee had agreed upon Professor Krylov as its chairman and spokesman, and it was he who alerted Major Pavlov that the committee was ready to report its considerations to the General Secretary. That was on the Saturday morning. Within hours, each of the four on the committee had been told to report to the Comrade General Secretary's weekend dacha at Usova. The other three came in their own cars. Major Pavlov drove Philby personally, and he was able to dispense with driver Grigoriev, the KGB pool chauffeur who had been driving him about for over 2 weeks. West of Moscow, across the Uspenskaya Bridge, and lying close to the banks of the Moskva River, is a complex of artificial villages round which are grouped the weekend dachas of the high and mighty in Soviet society. Even here the gradings are inflexible. At Peredelkina are the dachas of artists, academics, and military men. At Zhukovka, the Central Committee and others just below the Politburo. But the last named, the men at the supreme pinnacle, have their dachas grouped around Usova, the most exclusive of them all. The original Russian dacha was a country cottage, but these are veritable mansions of luxury, set in hundreds of acres of pine and birch forest, the territories patrolled round the clock by cohorts of 9th Directorate bodyguards to ensure the utter privacy and security of the Vlasti. Philby knew that every member of the Politburo, on elevation to that office, has the right to 4 residences. There is the family apartment on Kutuzovsky Prospect, which, unless the hierarch falls in disgrace, will remain in the family forever. Then there is the official villa in the Lenin Hills, always maintained with staff and comforts, inevitably bugged, and hardly ever used, save for the entertaining of foreign dignitaries. Thirdly comes the dacha in the forests west of Moscow, which the newly promoted big shot may design and build to his own tastes. Lastly, there is the summer retreat, often in the Crimea on the Black Sea. The General Secretary, however, had long ago had his summer retreat built at Kislovodsk, a mineral water spa in the Caucasus, specializing in the treatment of abdominal ailments. Philby had never seen the General Secretary's dacha at Usova. As the Chaika arrived that freezing evening, he observed it was long and low, of cut stone, with shingled roof, like the furniture at Kutuzovsky Prospekt, owing much to Scandinavian simplicity. Inside, the temperature was very high, and the General Secretary received them all in a spacious sitting room where a roaring log fire added to the heat. After the minimal formalities, the General Secretary gestured to Professor Krylov to reveal to him the Albion Committee's thinking.
You will understand, Comrade General Secretary, that what we have sought is a means of swinging a portion of the British electorate of not less than 10% across the nation to two cardinal viewpoints. One is a massive loss of their popular confidence in the existing Conservative government. The second, a conviction that in the election of a Labour government lies their best chances for contentment and security. In order to simplify that search, we asked ourselves if there was not perhaps one single issue which could dominate, or be brought to dominate, the entire election. After profound consideration, we have all come to the view that no economic aspect, not job losses, factory closures, increasing automation in industry, even public service cuts, would constitute this single issue we have been seeking. We believe there is but one, the greatest and most emotional non-economic political issue in Britain and all Western Europe at the present time. This is the question of nuclear disarmament. This has become huge in the West, involving millions of ordinary people. It is basically a question of mass fear, and it is this we feel should become the main thrust, the issue we should covertly exploit.
"And your specific proposals?" asked the General Secretary silkily.
"You will know, Comrade General Secretary, of our efforts so far in this field. Not millions, but billions of roubles have been spent encouraging the various anti-nuclear lobbies. In proposing to the West European people that unilateral nuclear disarmament really is synonymous with their best chance of peace, our covert efforts and the results have been remarkable, but nothing compared to what we believe should now be sought and achieved. The British Labour Party is the only one of four contesting the next election that is committed to unilateral nuclear disarmament. Our view is that all the stops should now be pulled out, using funds, disinformation, propaganda, to persuade that minimum wavering 10% of the British electorate to switch their vote, convinced at last that the Labour vote is the peace vote."
The silence, as they waited for the General Secretary's reaction, was almost tangible. He spoke at last. "Those efforts that we have made over 8 years, and of which you spoke, have they worked?" Professor Krylov looked as if he had been hit by an air-to-air missile. Philby caught the Soviet leader's mood and shook his head. The General Secretary noted the gesture and went on speaking. "For 8 years, we have put a vast effort into destabilizing the confidence on this issue. Today, true, all the unilateralist movements are so left-wing that by one means or another they have come under the control of our friends and work to our ends. The campaign has brought a rich harvest in agents of sympathy and influence, but..."
The General Secretary suddenly smacked both palms onto the arms of his wheelchair. The violent gesture in a man normally so ice-cold shook his four listeners badly.
"Nothing has changed!" shouted the General Secretary.
His voice then resumed its even tenor. "5 years ago, and 4 years ago, all the experts in the Central Committee and the universities and the KGB analytical study groups told us that the unilateralist movements were so powerful that they could stop the deployment of Cruz and Pershing. We believed that. We were misled. At Geneva, we dug our toes in, persuaded by our own propaganda that if we held on long enough, the governments of Western Europe would give in to the peace demonstrations we were covertly supporting and refuse to deploy Pershing and Cruz. But they did deploy, and we had to walk out." Philby nodded, looking suitably modest. Back in 1983, he had stuck his neck out with a paper suggesting the peacenik movement in the West, despite noisy popular demonstrations, would not swing any major election or change any government's mind. He had been proved right. Things, he suspected, were moving his way. "It rankles, comrades. It still rankles," said the General Secretary. "Now you are proposing more of the same. Comrade Colonel Thulby, what are the latest British public opinion polls on this issue?"
"Not good, I'm afraid," said Philby. "The last suggests 20% of the British now support unilateral nuclear disarmament, but even that is confusing. Among the working class, Labour's traditional voters, the figure is lower. It is a dismal fact, Comrade General Secretary, that the British working class is among the most conservative in the world. Polls also show they're amongst the most patriotic in a traditionalist way. During the Falklands affair, die-hard trade unionists threw the rule book into the dock and worked round the clock to get the warships ready for sea. I'm afraid if one is going to face harsh reality, one must admit the British working man has steadily refused to see that his best interests lie with us, or at least in a weakening of Britain's defences, and there is no reason to think he will change his mind now. Harsh reality. That is what I asked this committee to face, said the General Secretary. He paused again for several more minutes. Go away, comrades. Go back to your deliberations and bring me a plan, an active measure that will exploit that mass fear of which you spoke as never before, something that will persuade even level-headed men and women to vote to get rid of nuclear weapons from their soil, and thus to vote Labour. When they had gone, the old Russian rose and, with a stick, walked slowly to the window. He gazed out at the crackling birch forest beneath the snow. When he had swept to power, with his predecessor still unburied, he had been personally committed to the achievement of 5 tasks in the time left to him. He wanted to be remembered as the man who increased food production and a sufficient distribution, who doubled consumer goods in number and quality by a huge overhaul of chronically inefficient industry, who tightened party discipline at all levels, who extirpated the scourge of corruption that gnawed at the country's vitals, and who secured the final supremacy in men and arms over his country's serried ranks of enemies. 4 years later, he knew he had failed in them all. He was an old man and sick, and he knew time was running out. He had always prided himself on being a pragmatic man, a realistic man within the framework of strict Marxist orthodoxy. But even pragmatic men have their dreams, and old men have their vanities. His were simple. He wanted one gigantic triumph, one great moment that was his, and his alone. Just how much he wanted it, that bitter night, he alone knew. On the Sunday, Preston took a stroll past the house in Clanricarde Gardens, a street running due north from the Bayswater Road. Birkinshaw had been right. It was one of those once prosperous Victorian 5-story houses that had gone badly to seed, the sort now let out in bedsitters. Its small front area was weed-infested. 5 steps ran up to a peeling door above the street. From the front patch, a set of steps led down to a tiny basement area, with the top of a door just in view, the basement flat. He puzzled again as to why a senior civil servant and knight of the realm should wish to visit such a dingy place. Somewhere in vision he knew would be the watcher, probably in a parked vehicle with a long-lensed camera at the ready. He made no attempt to spot the man, but knew he himself would have been seen. On Monday he showed up in the log as an undistinguished character who walked by at 11:21 and showed some interest in the house. Thanks for nothing, he thought. On Monday morning he visited the local town hall and had a look at the list of ratepayers for that street. The address listed only one householder, a Michael Z. Mifsud. He was grateful for the Z. There could not be many like that around. Called up on the radio, the watcher at Clanricarde Gardens slipped across the road and checked the bell-push buttons. M. Mifsud was listed on the ground floor. Owner-occupier, thought Preston, letting out the rest of the house as furnished accommodation. Tenants of unfurnished property would pay their own local rates. In the late morning, he ran Michael Z. Mifsud through the immigration computer down at Croydon. He was from Malta, as his name implied, and had been in the country 30 years. Nothing known, but a question mark 15 years back. Not followed up, and no explanation. Scotland Yard's Criminal Records Office computer explained the question mark. The man had nearly been deported. Instead, he had served 2 years for living off immoral earnings. After lunch, Preston went to see Armstrong in finance at Charles Street. "Can I be an Inland Revenue Inspector tomorrow?" he asked. Armstrong sighed. "I'll try and fix it. Call back before closing time."
Then he went along to the legal adviser. "Would you ask Special Branch to fix me a search warrant for this address? Also, I want an SB sergeant on call to front me up. MI5 in Britain has no powers of arrest. Only a police officer can effect an arrest, save in emergencies, when a citizen's arrest is possible. When MI5 want to pick someone up, Special Branch usually oblige."
"You're not going to do a break-in?" asked the lawyer suspiciously.
"Certainly not," said Preston. "I want to wait until the tenant of this flat turns up, then move in and search. An arrest may be necessary, depending on the search. That's why I need the sergeant."
"All right," sighed the lawyer. "I'll get on to our tame magistrate. You'll have them both tomorrow morning."
Just before 5 that afternoon, Preston picked up his Inland Revenue identification from finance. Armstrong gave him another card with a telephone number. "If there's a query, have a suspect phone that number. It's the Inland Revenue in Wilson Green. Ask for Mr. Charnley. He'll vouch for you. Your name is Brent, by the way."
"So I see," said Preston.
Mr. Michael Z. Mifsud, interviewed the next morning, was not a nice man. Unshaven, in string vest, surly and uncooperative, but he let Preston into his grubby sitting room.
"What you tell me?" protested Mifsud. "What income? All I make, I declare."
"Mr. Mifsud, I assure you it's a routine spot check. Happens all the time. You declare all the rents. You've got nothing to hide."
"I got nothing to hide. So you take it up with my accountant," said Mifsud defiantly.
"I can if you wish," said Preston. "But I assure you we can ensure your accountant's fees will eventually come to an awful lot of money. Let me be frank. If the rents are in order, I just go away and do another spot check on someone else. But if, God forbid, any of these flats are let out for immoral purposes, that's different. Me, I'm concerned with income tax, but I'd be duty-bound to pass my findings on to the police. You know what living off immoral earnings means?"
"What do you mean?" protested Mifsud. "There's no immoral earnings here. It's all good tenants. They pay rents, I pay taxes, everything."
But he had gone a shade paler and grudgingly produced the rent books. Preston pretended to be interested in them all. He noted the basement was let to a Mr. Dickey at £40 a week. It took an hour to get all the details. Mifsud had never met the basement tenant. He paid by cash, regular as clockwork. But there was a typed letter originating the tenancy. It was signed by Mr. Dickey. Preston took the letter with him when he left, over Mr. Mifsud's protests. By lunchtime, he had handed it to Scotland Yard's graphology people, along with copies of Sir Richard Peter's handwriting and signature. By close of play, the Yard had rung him back. Same handwriting, but disguised. So, thought Preston, Peters himself maintains his own pied-à-terre. For cosy meetings with his controller? Most probably. Preston gave his orders. If Peters started heading towards the flat again, he, Preston, was to be alerted at once, wherever he was. The watch on the basement flat was to be maintained in case anyone else showed up. Wednesday dragged by, and Thursday. Then, as he left the ministry, Sir Richard Peters hailed a cab again and directed it towards Bayswater. The watchers contacted Preston in the bar at Gordon Street, whence he called Scotland Yard and hauled the designated Special Branch sergeant out of the canteen. He gave the man down the telephone the address. "Meet me on the pavement opposite, as fast as you can, but no noise," he said. They all congregated in the cold darkness of the pavement opposite the suspect house. Preston had dismissed his taxi 200 yards up the street. The Special Branch man had come in an unmarked branch car, which, with its driver, was parked with no lights around a corner. Detective Sergeant Lander turned out to be young and a bit green. It was his first bust with the MI5 people, and he seemed impressed. Harry Birkinshaw materialized out of the shadows. "How long's he been in there, Harry?"
55 minutes, said Birkinshaw.
"Any visitors?"
"Nope."
Preston took out a search warrant and showed it to Lander.
"Okay, let's go in," he said.
"Is it likely to be violent, sir?"
asked Lander. "Oh, I hope not," said Preston.